Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. On today's program, a story about how budget cuts might impact Wyoming's renowned special education services.
I think it's the mentality that he can grow up and be self-sufficient and support a family or go to Mars or whatever it is that he wants to do.
We'll also hear a civil dialogue over whether Evanston should build an ICE immigration detention center.
They are treated like prisoners, whether we like it or not. They're prisoners because they cannot leave.
For some teens living in the Mountain West, gun control feels like a threat to their heritage.
I've grown up with guns my whole life. My dad and grandpa are really fond of them.
And we'll also hear about Congresswoman Liz Cheney's thoughts on enhanced interrogation methods. That and more, all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Reports that President Trump's pick to head the CIA oversaw the enhanced interrogation methods used under the Bush administration has sparked a debate about their validity in Congress. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney is defending them, even as critics say they amount to torture.
Trump's unexpected reshuffling of his cabinet has also brought with it an unexpected debate over what critics say amounted to torture in the Bush-Cheney administration. Many senators are already lining up against Gina Haspel to become the new CIA director because she oversaw those programs and later destroyed videotapes of some of the sessions. But Congresswoman Liz Cheney fully supports her and says there was nothing wrong with the waterboarding and other techniques employed.
I think it's very important that we recognize that folks that sort of stand up and say, well, that was torture and we shouldn't waterboard, number one, they're wrong. And number two, they've got to then be willing to say how many American lives are they willing to sacrifice because they don't want to waterboard a terrorist.
Cheney dismisses critics and defends the program that many political watchers say tarnished her father's tenure.
You know, it's a longstanding debate, and, you know, obviously we're on different sides of that issue. I think it's really important now that, you know, we're looking at confirming the next Secretary of State, the next director of the CIA, the first woman director of the CIA, that, you know, we be clear about the history, be clear about the facts.
Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul announced he opposes Haspel, which led to Cheney criticizing him. But Paul says the Cheney name represents
everything that's been wrong about foreign policy for the last 40 years.
Paul says the debate over nominees will give him and his colleagues ample time to air their criticisms of the neoconservative interventionist policies that marked the Bush-Cheney administration. He says most Republicans today have abandoned that way of thinking.
You know, I think there's a great deal of movement away from the Cheneys, and the Cheneys have a lot of explaining to do for all the thousands of people who died in an unnecessary war.
Cheney says Paul's isolationist perspective is the one that's out of step with the public.
I think that Senator Paul's wrong on most of them, probably all of them as far as I've seen. But luckily his perspective and his viewpoint is not shared by a majority of the people in this party or a majority of Americans.
Last weekend, Cheney traveled down to Paul's home turf in Kentucky to speak at a Lincoln Reagan Day dinner. She says even Paul's own constituents are on her side.
You know, it was a situation where, as I said, you know, I mentioned in my remarks how important the enhanced interrogation program had been, that it wasn't torture, and, you know, that I wasn't willing to sacrifice any American lives if you could save them by waterboarding a terrorist, and that got, you know, standing ovation from the crowd.
Still, some prominent Republicans, like Arizona Senator John McCain and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, are demanding answers from Haspel, and they say she needs to denounce the techniques she oversaw during the Bush-Cheney administration.
Well, I don't think it's a debate. I think there is no debate. The law prohibits waterboarding and all interrogation techniques like that. Clear and unequivocal prohibition. And I would hope that the CIA nominee agrees with me.
Those criticisms don't work on Cheney, who remains steadfast in her support for her father's administration.
We won't sacrifice one American life if, you know, the alternative is you waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So I think, it's an issue as we go forward. There are a whole bunch of really crucial national security issues we need to be focused on.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
According to state politics, the Wyoming legislature spent roughly $40 million on a variety of economic development initiatives aimed at creating jobs and diversifying the economy. Some left the session very excited about what they did, while others were anxious. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Wyoming has dipped its toe into the water of economic development in the past, but while there are successes, there has also been millions of dollars spent that didn't pan out. Just review the state's history of spending on alternative uses for coal as a prime example. So, the legislature's support of the latest effort to diversify the economy, known as Endow, is a little surprising, especially at a time when the state is worried about its revenue. Cheyenne Representative Dan Zwanitzer has served 14 years in the House. He says diversifying the economy is a good idea.
You know, this session we did take a huge leap of faith forward on multiple initiatives, up to $45 million out of our legislative stabilization account to try to put forth some initiatives that will pay off for us in the future. So there's some optimism.
Worland Representative Michael Greer isn't optimistic. He's frustrated with all the unknowns.
You know, the state's at this crossroads. We're trying to figure out who we're going to be going forward for the next 20 years. And, you know, so we're talking about we don't want to rely on oil and gas. How do we do economic development? And we're not quite sure how to do it, but we got some good ideas.
Or at least they may seem like good ideas. One idea sets aside $15 million to allow Wyoming to partner with air service companies. Another spends money to enhance high-speed broadband in the state. And the Kickstart program provides seed money for entrepreneurs to create businesses in the state. Greer is chairman of the House Minerals, Business, and Economic Development Committee, and he was far from being a rubber stamp.
The skeptic in me is saying, okay, I don't think some of these are going to work. I didn't support the air enhancement bill. The Kickstart program was another one I didn't support, and not because we don't need to try to stimulate from the ground up, but I have concerns about giving grants to individuals under our current constitutional structure.
Afton Senator Dan Dockstader is a member of the Appropriations Committee, and he also wonders about spending on ideas when money is tight.
Some of it I had caution with because, to me, I couldn't see a solid return on it.
Dockstader was a fan of getting broadband to rural areas, such as his home base, the Star Valley area. He even developed a plan, but then something happened.
Literally while we were talking about it, and I was home, over the internet comes a news release that one of the major companies in the state put $5 million to take that exact route up. So I'm asking, why should we put state money there when the private sector is investing $5 million in the very route that I was looking at?
He thinks better communication with the private sector should be explored instead of spending state dollars. And it's not just Republicans. House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly voted for many of the initiatives, but she's not sure she loves where Endow is heading.
In particular about the mix of jobs that we're courting, honestly, if Endow goes down the road that it is moving. And I want to see jobs that both men and women will be employed in. They're going far too much towards those sectors that employ predominantly men.
Connolly is also worried that while they're spending money on economic development, other programs may suffer. Others were very supportive of the legislation that passed, including bills that could make Wyoming a player when it comes to blockchain technology. But they add that Wyoming will not truly be free from relying on the energy sector unless it changes the way it taxes other businesses. Cody Senator Hank Coe is excited about a business in his community, but he agrees that the state may not be getting the revenue it could be getting.
Cody Labs is just, you know, on its way to employ 350 people. That's the kind of stuff we need, but they still, through assessed valuation of commercial assessed valuation, 11.5% of market, it's still going to take so much of that to pick up the slack that Minerals used to carry.
So making sure all businesses contribute equally to the tax base may be the next conversation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Coming up, a civil dialogue about Evanston's plan to build an immigration detention center. You're listening to Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The country's debate over immigration is escalating, and now it's arrived in Wyoming. A private company wants to build an immigration detention center on the outskirts of Evanston, on Wyoming's western border. This was met with great celebration by many local folks, like Uinta County Commissioner Craig Welling. To him, it means jobs.
We've been in boom and bust cycles, and that's been a challenge for our economy, because when it's good, it's been really good. And when it's been bust, it's been really not very good. And we're challenged right now with one of those downside times.
And Welling says those downside times have affected his family.
My wife and I had 8 children. Well, if we looked at these numbers right now, 4 of our children have remained in the state of Wyoming and 4 have not. We're losing our young people that equates to the workforce of Wyoming. And if we don't have a valid workforce, our economic growth is not going to happen. And that means that our populations and our opportunities are going to start constricting.
And that's why city and county officials, including Welling, voted unanimously for the ICE Detention Center, which made some Wyomingites, like longtime Evanston resident and former Democratic state legislator Sandra Meyer, pretty mad. She says most immigrants aren't criminals and don't deserve to go to jail. But both Meyer and Welling do agree that right now in the U.S., it's hard to have a reasonable conversation about immigration. So I traveled to Evanston to sit down with the two of them for our series, I Respectfully Disagree. They've both spent decades in public service hashing out big problems in their communities, making them great models for how to talk about hard things civilly. Meyer says she understands why Welling wants to see all his children and grandchildren have good-paying jobs in Evanston.
That's one of the things, as we look for industry or companies that want to come here, what kind of jobs are they going to be? Are they going to be hourly jobs? Are they going to be higher paying jobs? Because if they're just lower paying jobs, are these people going to be able to survive? Are they going to be able to find housing? I think we have to be discriminating as to what kind of industries and businesses and that type of thing we are attracting.
Yeah, so maybe you could continue that thought. Just, you know, what concerns do you have about the kind of jobs that this detention center would bring?
From what I understand, they have said that they are $21 an hour jobs. But as I've done research and found out that in other facilities that they've had, they have in New Mexico, Texas, and California.
Here, Meyer is referring to the private Utah-based company Management Training Corporation, or MTC.
California, they might, because of the economy in California. But from what I understand, the other places are only paying like $12 to $14 an hour. So again, are these going to be the majority of jobs?
Yeah, yeah. What's your reaction to what she's having to say here, Craig, about some of the concerns about this particular company and its history?
Well, I think Sandra's wonderful.
Now he's going to tell you what I answered, why he doesn't agree with me.
Right. And?
Well, in response to that, there's definitely some concern with some of the issues she brings forward. We're being told that these jobs will bring forward about $45,000 a year plus federal benefits. And some of the things that she's alluding to is very accurate. Those issues can enumerate from suicides to poor food to not clean facilities, you know, on and on and on. I think what Homeland Security or ICE is trying to do, and I think it's been demonstrated in this facility in Calexico is they've become more aware of some of these issues and they're trying to step it up.
And I know that one of the concerns was whether or not Evanston will have immigration lawyers who can specialize in making sure that they are taking care of each of these people, you know, because like you said, most of them will just be civil cases, but they will need a pretty specialized representation.
This has been one of my concerns. In fact, we did meet with Craig and the county commissioners and our county attorney, and that was one of my questions. And her response was, there is one lawyer in Jackson. Otherwise, they have to depend on Salt Lake City. So will they be able to get legal services in a timely manner?
I mean, that might be a question that, you know, how could Evanston maybe bring those types of lawyers here? Is that a possibility? Is that something that the community is looking into? What kind of solution can you guys maybe come up with for that problem?
Some of the initial things that could be done as far as legal representation could be done through potential teleconferencing. That's done in criminal situations all over the United States at this point in time.
Does that reassure you?
Not really. Knowing and having worked with teleconferencing, you don't have that personal. And I'm going to go into my speech therapy background, and this is that there's different percentages, but 70% of communication is nonverbal. Okay, so 30% is going to be your words. So when you have teleconference, you're not having that interchange, actually, that I would think needs to take place.
Meyer is also worried about how an immigration detention center could affect Evanston's ability to attract tourists and new businesses, new families. She doesn't like that the center would be built near the state visitor center. Craig assured her it wouldn't be visible from there. Then the conversation took another turn.
I think there are some issues that we should address in terms of humane treatment of these folks while they are detained. But at the end of the day, according to our laws, they do not have the right to be on American soil. And some of the reasons for these laws is to avoid human trafficking, to avoid terrorism, to avoid drug trafficking, to avoid money laundering.
Well, I have some concerns from some of our very, very wealthy people in the United States who are money laundering and doing these things. I think we kind of stereotype. But, you know, looking at this as an actual facility, and they are prison rooms. Not only that, when they have people come and visit them like family, they have to speak to them through a two-way glass. It's not, this is a nice little thing and we're going to, you know, they are treated like prisoners, whether we like it or not. They're prisoners because they cannot leave.
Any thoughts on that?
Oh, you bet. I was at a restaurant here a couple weeks ago and I had a Hispanic couple came to me, not once but twice, and I didn't invite it. I was eating and they came to me and they says, "Don't you back down." And I says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "We support this detention facility. We came here, we did the things that were required of us to become solid United States citizens, and we believe that that's the way it ought to be." So there's another point of view.
After that, we started wrapping up.
I think the important thing for the county commissioners as well as the mayor and the city council is that we keep an open mind. I think it's extremely important that we always have an open door so people who have an opinion or a concern can express them and express them freely, not feel intimidated doing that.
And I appreciate that we have had the opportunity to meet with the commissioners and to voice our opinion and any way that we can help, you know, in helping you make the decision, I think we would be willing to do.
I had to smile at our last meeting. I got the feeling they were trying to save us from ourselves.
We still are, but...
And so,
well, I don't want you to be voted out because no.
She's just trying to help her.
I'm just trying to help you.
And so that's how it's done by the masters. Sure, hold your position, but concede that the other guy has some good points. Crack some jokes. Be respectful. On a friendly note, we all parted ways. Now, it's just a matter of waiting for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency to decide whether the company's proposal will even be approved. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
To hear more of our civil dialogues, visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Next on the show, how budget cuts could affect special education and how lawmakers strengthen protections for victims of sexual violence. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. In an effort to curb the rising costs of K-12 education, the state legislature voted to cap spending on special education and directed the Wyoming Department of Education to come up with efficiencies. While educators agree there's room for improvements, they say Wyoming's rural nature complicates things. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson takes a look.
Hey, Jack. It's Mrs. Reed.
Hi.
And I brought a friend with me, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything else named Tennessee?
A state.
A state. Can we go back to your room and get your coat and your outdoor cane? And we'll go for a walk?
Sure.
Okay.
This time last year, I spent an afternoon with 6-year-old Jack and his teacher, Tia Reed. Jack is visually impaired, and he was practicing using his cane to get from his school to the neighboring community center. His first challenge? A big old pickup truck barreling down the street. But Jack knew to wait and listen for the sound of the engine to go away.
I think it's safe.
Okay, let's go.
Jack rolled the cane back and forth in front of him, scanning the ground to find the curb, and then confidently crossed the street. He works on these skills with Mrs. Reed so that soon he'll be able to make the journey on his own. But Reed, who is a teacher for the visually impaired and an orientation and mobility specialist, only gets to work with Jack a couple times a month. That's because Jack lives in the town of Saratoga, 80 miles up and over the Snowy Range Mountains from Mrs. Reed's home in Albany County. The majority of the school year, that route is closed. So Reed takes the long way around. She says that commute is nothing. Before she got her certification, Jack was working with a teacher who lived almost 3 hours away.
She would drive from Lander and see him just because that was the closest one. So I'm the closest one to Jack now.
That kind of windshield time is not uncommon for teachers like Reed. When she's not traveling to meet with individual clients like Jack, she also works half days at Laramie High School. She says there just aren't that many specialists like her in Wyoming, and that's part of what makes special education so expensive. The state spends about $230 million a year. So in an effort to pare down the K-12 budget, the legislature is looking at special education. Cody Senator Hank Coe, who serves on multiple education committees, says the funding model itself might be driving up the cost.
Because based on Supreme Court decisions we had back in the 90s, the Campbell decisions, the choice was made by the Wyoming legislature to reimburse special education at 100%.
Coe says the current 100% reimbursement policy means Wyoming provides excellent special ed services, but little incentive for districts to find efficiencies.
You know, I think we have some duplication of resources that are used when it comes to dealing with special education. If we can find efficiencies in how we share resources, you know, that's just one area where I think, you know, probably we could, you know, find some efficiencies. We're hoping that Wyoming Department of Education can come up with some of that stuff for us.
And they better, because the legislature has capped the special education reimbursement for the next 2 years to the amount districts spend this year. The WDE has 6 months to make recommendations about how to reduce spending without impacting services.
If it's a service that a child has to have, you're stuck.
That's Peg Montese, the special ed director for the Park 6 School District up in Cody. She has over 20 years of experience at the district, state, and federal level. I told her about Jack and Mrs. Reed, and she said it's not uncommon for schools to hire contractors. She tries to share services with neighboring districts as much as she can, but sometimes...
You're going to pay $90 an hour for speech language or for a teacher for the visually impaired because you simply have no choice.
That's because the federal government says schools have to meet students' needs. Monteith says the WDE could look at creating more salaried positions for specialists who would serve multiple districts in a given region. That would reduce the time and money it takes to negotiate a contract every time a school needs a specialist, and would at least make personnel costs more predictable. She's excited for Wyoming to work on coming up with solutions.
If we come up with that answer, we can take our show on the road, actually, because we will have solved an issue for a lot of states.
But she's worried the statewide funding cap could get the state into trouble. If districts exceed the funding cap for special education, they'll have to siphon money from their general funds.
When that happens, and I saw that happen in Colorado when I was the state director there, then it begins to impact all students because you are reducing your funding for all students.
Jack's mom, Sarah Chatfield, is also thinking about the state's bottom line. She says a strong investment now will pay off in the long run.
The studies have shown that if he wasn't a Braille reader, there was like a 90% chance that he would be either underemployed or unemployed. And then for kids like Jack who do learn Braille, then it's a 90% chance that he'll earn what his peers earn.
She wants him to be financially independent and able to follow his dreams.
And I think it's the mentality that he can grow up and be self-sufficient and support a family or go to Mars or whatever it is that he wants to do. He has the tools for it.
In theory, lawmakers want that too. They just don't want it to cost so much. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Lawmakers didn't spend all their time talking about reining in spending. Advocates for victims of domestic abuse and sexual violence are celebrating some big wins after this year's legislative session. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard spoke with Tara Muir, the public policy director for the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, who has been characterizing this session in two different ways.
The first way is this was the year of the survivor. We passed a lot of bills to hold offenders accountable, but what our coalition works most for is to make sure survivors have safety. And this year we had two survivors testify on bills important to them, one that brings child sexual abuse prevention to the schools. It's not mandatory, but it's permissive. And another one is about protecting patients from sexual harassment by healthcare providers. And then some of the big important stuff from a lot of the other bills was that survivors now, when they go get a protection order, can ask the judge to make them up to 3 years long rather than the current 1 year long. And then also ask that they be awarded their cell phones and their cell phone numbers. And the judge can have part of that protection order just let the cell phone companies know what they need to do to make that happen. That's a small but really annoying barrier that victims are facing in our state. So those are some of the Year of the Survivor big wins that I think we've had. The second way we're looking at it is it really is a new day in Wyoming. And I don't know if part of that is the Me Too movement, the national movement that's been in the back of legislators' mind all session. But they really passed some bills to really enhance penalties if you're charged and convicted of domestic assault and battery. Those are really hard on the offenders. And I think it's a new day that our state legislature spoke in one voice and said, you will not do this in Wyoming, or you're facing some serious consequences now.
Can you expand a little on the impact that you've seen the Me Too movement have on lawmakers and how the conversation is going forward?
In the work we do, having a survivor's voice front and center is so important. And we've been doing this since the beginning of battered women's work and the rape movement. And being able to see in the headlines every day different survivors from all walks of life and all parts of the country come forward with stories, I think really helped embolden not only us as staff that finally we're getting real airtime and the whole world is seeing how prevalent these issues are, whether it's sexual harassment or sexual assault. There's a continuum that we look at when we talk about the Me Too movement. I think it helps survivors in our own state be willing to share their stories more openly and be willing to take a stand and ask the legislature to do something for them so that no one else would have to suffer like they did. And that's a big deal.
Did you see that reflected in the testimony given during some of these committee meetings and hearings during this legislative session?
Yes. I think all the senators or the House of Representatives were very engaged with the survivors and really interested in what they had to say, had lots of good questions for some of them as well, which is good. And survivors can handle those questions because they've been through it. And I think it was a great education for any of the legislators. I hope we can keep that up every year.
What were some of those big wins for the coalition in detail?
What was a big win a year ago was having Senator Kinski ask the Joint Judiciary Committee to have an interim study on all of the laws that we focus on, domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. So all of 2017, the Joint Judiciary Committee was really looking at what can we do better. They came up with three bills that we really helped lobby for, in addition to some of the ones we've talked about. And those were the enhancing penalties bills, particularly in stalking. It also helped expand the ability for judges to have jurisdiction over cases when the stalking is actually started from a different state, but the damage is done here to the victim. The big win in that, which isn't let's throw everybody in jail for longer, it's let's extend probation. Currently, it's just 1 year for most of those crimes, and we were able to get that also up to 3 years probation. When somebody's a first-time offender with assault or battery, we want the community and any services that are available to really be able to work its magic with someone who, okay, maybe didn't know better. But as these bills got passed, once you have a second conviction, you do know better. And so you're going to get the book thrown at you.
Tara Muir, it seems like the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and other advocacy groups, that there was a lot of good things, positive things that got passed this session. Was there any legislation that you weren't happy with?
One was the Stand Your Ground law. We testified against that. We know, and the research is very clear, that when there's a firearm present in a family, the chances of the intimate partner, victim, or a child being hurt is exponentially higher. I think some research says 7 times higher, that gun's going to be used against a victim of abuse rather than that victim of abuse using it to defend themselves. Those are big concerns of ours, and we were really hoping Governor Meade would veto that. I understand he didn't sign it, but it is still law in this state. So we'll be looking at ways to maybe help that law get amended a little bit.
A lot of work got done in the 2017 interim session. What are you setting your sights on as we enter another interim session?
Well, we definitely all believe we didn't give enough attention to sexual assault at all. And so we asked for another, that the interim study continue, basically, and really address some of the sexual assault issues that have surfaced, particularly in the Casper area. Lots of great survivors speaking out up there. But there's problems across the state. There's some discussion about we really need better definitions about what alcohol-facilitated rape is so we can prosecute that better. But at this point, we don't think the Joint Judiciary Committee is going to take that up as a study. I don't think they officially decide until mid-April, and the Management Council gets to weigh in on that. So if anyone wants to weigh in with their Judiciary Committee members and ask that they reconsider that sexual assault be a higher priority during this interim, we'd love that. Sexual assault was left behind, and we need to start talking about that a lot more.
Tara Muir is the Public Policy Director for the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Switching gears to energy issues, self-bonding is a way for coal companies to guarantee cleanup costs without putting any money down. It's been long criticized for its risk to taxpayers. Now, the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality has released proposed rules that would limit self-bonding. While some are happy to see changes in progress, Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports others say it's too strict.
Back in 2011, the coal market looked great. Three of the largest coal companies in the world, all with mines in Wyoming, invested big in metallurgical coal, the kind used for infrastructure.
Each company took on hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of debt.
That's Peter Morgan, an attorney for the Sierra Club. The debt wasn't necessarily a bad thing until 2015.
And then the price of coal started dropping, and the companies were no longer able to pay the interest on that debt.
Morgan says this sudden drop made it clear Alpha Natural Resources, Peabody Energy, and Arch Coal would soon declare bankruptcy. In fact, he represented a coalition of environmental organizations in the proceedings. The three bankruptcies left a big question mark around how these companies would pay cleanup costs here in Wyoming. After all, they hadn't put any money down due to a sort of insurance-type method called self-bonding, which is basically an IOU from mining companies to later pay for reclamation.
Essentially, unenforceable promises that the company is just never going to go out of business.
But they did. The companies had self-bonds valued at around $1.5 billion that almost fell on taxpayers' shoulders. They did eventually manage to avoid it.
The big lesson that the state and others learned was that the self-bonding system was inherently flawed and needed to be fixed.
And now that's happening. Proposed rules have been in the making for about a year now, though the process started in 2013. Self-bonding began in the early 80s. Kyle Wentland, an administrator for the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, says the proposed final rules are intended to bring self-bonding up to date with today's more complex financial structures.
It's a change to be reflective of what things look like at this point in time today. The development of the operations, the risks, all of the owners, all of that looks very different from what it did 30 years ago.
The proposed new rules add significant limits to self-bonding that help reduce the risk to taxpayers. For instance, one proposal would force companies to diversify how they bond. The DEQ would cap self-bonding at 75% of their cleanup obligations, down from 100%. And that's only companies with the strongest financial situations.
In your own financial investing, you don't put everything in one financial instrument. Most people have a variety of mutual funds or other investments for that very reason, to spread that risk.
The remaining percentage can be bonded using methods including real property collateral or third-party bonds. The proposed regulations would also prohibit backing bonds with machinery or equipment, limit self-bonding to mines that have at least 10 years of life ahead. These potential regulatory changes are just a few.
On the whole, the proposals are definitely a step in the right direction.
That's Sierra Club attorney Peter Morgan again. He says he'd prefer the method to be done away with entirely, but if that's not going to happen, he's glad to finally see limits.
It's a recognition that these sophisticated multinational companies were able to take advantage of those loopholes in the older regulations, and that there's some, you know, just common sense fixes that can be put into place.
One of those loopholes Morgan is happy to see closing allowed companies to use subsidiaries to qualify for self-bonds without having to look at a parent company's financial health.
It was really just a matter of shifting numbers around on the balance sheets, and those subsidiaries really shouldn't have qualified.
Morgan adds now is a perfect time to make the transition to new bonding methods, given there is significantly less self-bonding today in Wyoming than there was a decade ago. Only three coal companies still use it in the state. One of those is Rocky Mountain Power's Bridger Coal Company, with around $170 million still in self-bonds. Company spokesman Dave Eskelson says there will be impacts to Bridger if the rules are changed.
The rule as proposed would likely increase the cost of providing electric service for our customers, because the company's ability to self-bond has a significant benefit to our customers.
Other industry members have voiced similar concerns. Head of the Wyoming Mining Association, Travis Detai, says the proposed standards are now too strict.
It has to be something that companies can take advantage of. We don't believe that the standards should be set so high that a company simply can't use it.
The DEQ's Land Quality Division's advisory board will meet March 28th to discuss the final proposed rules. A public comment period is open until then. If the rules are approved, the Environmental Quality Council will be the next in line to consider them. Finalizing the amended rules is still at least a year away. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Ahead, we talk to teenagers in the Mountain West about gun control. Stay with us right here on Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. This weekend, hundreds of thousands of teens are expected to march on D.C. and around the country calling for gun control. Today, we're going to hear from students who are on both sides of the issue. The first two in Montana and Wyoming who do not plan to march and are worried stricter gun control could change their way of life.
High school senior Braden Brand is chilling with a friend next to his pickup truck in Missoula, Montana.
I think a lot of people are afraid of guns. Maybe that's why they're against them.
But for Brandt and many kids in the region, guns are a way of life. They've been shooting them as soon as they were old enough to pull a trigger.
For my first birthday, my dad's buddy got me a Chipmunk 22 single-shot long rifle. I started shooting that probably when I was 5 or 6 with assistance from my dad.
Brandt says his dad and grandpa collect guns, pistols, hunting rifles, AR-15s.
I've grown up with guns my whole life. My dad and grandpa are really fond of them.
In fact, people in Montana own some of the most guns per capita in the country. They also have one of the highest firearm death rates in the U.S. But one of the reasons Brandt feels safe in his school is because they've got a designated police officer there. Still, he recognizes that armed officers didn't stop the Parkland shooting.
I'm a firm believer that police can't protect everyone. And so that's why we have like the Second Amendment, so people can have the right to protect themselves and protect their families.
And he says people who are afraid of guns need to get more comfortable with guns. And even learn how to use one.
I think it'd change a lot of people's views. Because once you shoot one and you're comfortable, I think it provides an opportunity for you to know what's going on and not be afraid.
But is he afraid in a climate where mass shootings seem to be becoming more common?
I don't know. I guess it's something I choose not to worry about because I guess I have no control over it.
And while he doesn't have control over that, he says he doesn't want to lose control over his right to own guns. I'm Nate Hedgie in Missoula, Montana.
And I'm Maggie Mullen in Centennial, Wyoming. Less than 300 people live here, including 17-year-old Courtney Borer. She goes to high school in Laramie, 30 miles away.
Pretty early mornings. I have to wake up at 5:30. The bus picks us up at 6:30.
She says she doesn't talk much in school about her views on guns.
I mean, I don't really have these discussions with my classmates because I kind of feel as if my voice gets drowned out.
Borer says some of her peers have become very vocal about gun control since the Parkland, Florida shooting and, in her opinion, villainizing guns.
I've always seen them as more of a tool. I mean, a dangerous tool that you have to be careful with, but still a tool nonetheless.
Borer says she's always felt comfortable around guns as a hunter and as a competitive shooter. She first started competing when she was 11. She's gotten good too and has won several competitions.
I mean, it's a pretty nice feeling when you hit that 10X dead on. It's like that feeling of accomplishment.
She says she's trying to earn a spot on the women's rifle team at the University of Nebraska, but she's concerned if the legal age to purchase a semi-automatic firearm is raised from 18 to 21, her plans for college will have to change.
They don't provide you with your own guns to shoot with. You have to buy those yourself.
Her concern about gun regulation isn't just about her college plans. She says gun ownership is part of life here in Wyoming. For one thing, she says, her family hunts for their meat instead of buying it at the grocery store.
All of our meals, like the meat, is either deer or elk that we have shot and that we have harvested ourselves.
Still, Laura says she isn't ruling out all gun control. There's one regulation she'd support.
A required gun safety course in order to buy and own a firearm.
Bora turns 18 in June. She plans to buy her own rifle as soon as she does. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Maggie Mullen in Wyoming.
Now we go to Colorado, where we hear from two students who are inspired by the movement. Allie Budner reports from Colorado Springs.
Thea Roland is a high school junior. She's into reading, modern dance, and politics.
I think what's happening because of the Florida shooting is amazing. I mean, I'm online. I can see that stuff is happening.
And she feels part of it, too. Last week, she walked out of class with hundreds of her peers to say to the world,
"We matter more than guns." That's just something that I like. I feel like we shouldn't have to say that, but we're trying to say that loudly and with force.
She says she's frustrated that school shootings keep happening and that elected officials aren't passing laws to change that. She wants them to pay attention to the message she and other teens are delivering.
You signed up to do something. As a congressman or a congresswoman, it is your job, literally, to make this a safer, happier world. There's a lot more to be done, and that's your job. That's your job.
But she's not necessarily counting on them either. She's only 17, but she says this movement might factor into what she does with her future.
Yeah, I think that's involved in what I want to learn about and what I want to do with my life. Just, I want to stay angry enough to do something about it. Because obviously, if my generation is the only one that's pushing for this, then we have to be a lot stronger than we are even now. We have to keep going.
For now, though, the march is a start.
I'm just so happy that someone's finally doing something, and it's my generation. We're doing something. We're mobile, and it's fantastic.
I'm Allie Budner in Colorado Springs.
And I'm Amanda Peacher in Boise, Idaho. Like Thea Roland, 17-year-old Riley White didn't plan on becoming an activist.
It angers me so much that the responsibility has been passed down to my generation to fight for the right to go to school.
Riley has been thinking about gun violence for a long time.
I honestly feel like Sandy Hook was my generation's 9/11. I was sitting in my language arts classroom, and my teacher walked in, tears running down her face, and told us about the students that had been shot and killed at Sandy Hook. I remember exactly what I was doing. I remember exactly how I felt. I remember the rest of the school day, how everybody could not stop crying.
Riley was just 13 at the time.
It's so hard to think about because I'm so close with my family that, especially my little brother who's still in elementary school, thinking about that happening is the most terrifying thing that I could think of. Losing my family is just heartbreaking.
Her state, Idaho, has one of the highest per capita gun ownership rates in the nation. She says even though she's never personally touched a gun, she doesn't feel like she's missing out on a cultural experience.
I know that many people have a passion for hunting and things like that, and they need firearms for that. But my life is no less fulfilled or lacking in any way by not seeing or owning or possessing a firearm.
She says she respects her fellow Idahoans' right to have guns, but she's hoping lawmakers will respect American students' rights to be safe in school. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher in Boise, Idaho.
Thanks so much for joining us for Open Spaces. You can hear the entire program again and listen to individual segments at our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
While you're there, sign up for our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
If you're a subscriber, we'd appreciate it if you'd rate it and write a comment, and a rater is our web editor.
If there are topics you wish we'd cover on this program, you can submit those through our Facebook page or on our website.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.